Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. The heart is an organ of immense complexity and vital importance to virtually everything we do. Without a healthy heart, our lives become limited and often include other health complications. So how do we keep our hearts healthy? How can we change the way we live so that we improve the health of our heart? What do you do if you have been diagnosed with heart disease? Well, please stay with us for the next hour as cardiologist Dr. Jonathan McDonough answers these questions and others about heart disease and heart health. Welcome to the program, Dr. McDonough. I appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Good morning, Prentice. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, I want to take just a second and remind people we are live today, and we will be accepting phone calls. So if you have a question for Dr. McDonough about heart health, or you want to share an experience or something that you've done in your life to improve your heart health, there are three ways to connect with us. If you are in the Anchorage area, our phone number is 907-550-8433. If you're listening outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to join us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E @alaskapublic.org. And we'll do our best to get your questions on the air. If you do have a question today, please don't wait until the last, like, 5 minutes or so, because you get a bunch of phone calls and can't get your questions on the air. All right, so let's get into this. Dr. McDonough, first off, I guess, you are my cardiologist, so it's kind of, and I've had some heart things, which is kind of the genesis or the behind this show today, and it's my chance to get some free medical advice from you.
Like, for sure, yeah. We'll send you a bill after the show.
Okay. I guess start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself, your background in medicine, and what you're doing, where you're at now.
Yeah, sure. Well, first, appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'll mention it several times throughout the show, but nothing that I do is possible without a whole lot of support from my partners and colleagues at Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, and also the hospitals with which we partner, which includes Providence and Alaska Regional, as well as the Peninsula on Central Peninsula and Matsu Regional Medical Center. So it's a complex, layered system that I'm a part of. I came to, the short story is I grew up in New England. Both of my parents were scientists and, in fact, studied aspects of cardiovascular disease. And so I kind of grew up learning about a lot of stuff and from a kind of a basic science level, and thought I might head in that direction. But when I was in college, realized I didn't have the patience or I wasn't suited to be in a lab, let's put it that way.
Okay.
And realized that human interactions and working with people was really where my passion lay, and ultimately ended up choosing a career in medicine. And I made my way out west to Seattle for my internal medicine residency, and through the WAMI connections, was able to come to Alaska, and then ultimately ended up, my wife and I came up and practiced general internal medicine on the Kenai for a number of years before I went back for further training in cardiovascular disease and interventional cardiology, and then ended up being very fortunate to be able to come back here and join my partners at the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, where I now practice.
Yeah. All right, so I mean, why the heart? You mentioned your parents were kind of into the cardiovascular thing. I mean, why did you decide on the heart? There's a lot of areas of medicine. What pulled you to that?
Yeah, there are a lot of areas. And, there's a lot of different reasons, but part of it's mentors that you run into along the way. And one of the great things about heart disease from a physician and care system standpoint is the amount of tools that we have to bring to bear to both prevent and treat heart disease. It's very satisfying. So from that standpoint, it's a very satisfying specialty to practice because people get better. And people who are sick get better, and you can often prevent people from getting sick. And heart disease is also super common. We still our organ remains the number one cause of death and disability in the world, right? Not just the United States, it's worldwide. And so there's a lot of work to do, and it's satisfying work. And I think the third component for a lot of us in cardiology is there's a lot of layers of skills that we get to use. Mm-hmm. So there's cognitive skills and also manual skills and to a certain extent, types of engineering skills almost, depending on what subspecialty we might be involved with. And so in my world as an interventional cardiologist, we're often, acutely treating blocked arteries for heart attacks or implanting new valves to relieve an obstructed valve. And that the sort of evaluation of the patient before those procedures and then actually doing those procedures is all, fairly technical and can be real satisfying. Yeah.
You've mentioned that there's, I don't know if there's plumbers and electricians in cardiology. What do you mean by that? And what's your area of focus?
Yeah. So I'm squarely a plumber. Kind of what I mean by that is within the heart and vascular system, if you just think about the heart as a pump, the pump needs, the muscle of the pump needs to work. The electrical signals that control the muscle need to work, and the inflow and outflow of the pump needs to work, and the flow of blood to supply the pump with energy needs to work.
And those valves that work one way, they all have to work.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot.
There's a lot that goes into it. So within that realm, so my colleagues down the hall, probably the best kind of analogy is the electrician, or the technical term is clinical cardiac electrophysiologist.
Okay.
Those are physicians who specialize in the signaling mechanism that controls the heart rhythm. Okay. And there is a very complex and detailed world that they live in and do procedures to control rhythm problems in the heart, and sometimes medications too.
So a person might see more than one cardiologist?
Yeah, for sure. Especially people with advanced heart disease who have developed problems often develop more than one problem because these things are all interrelated. So it's very common for our patients with heart failure, which is a term I'm happy to expand on, to see me for their plumbing. They'll see my colleague who specializes in heart failure. So often in the medication adjustment, which is very powerful, to help those patients live longer, that person will see that heart failure specialist and also see the electrophysiology specialist to make sure the rhythm is in control. And often, sometimes those patients need special pacemakers or defibrillators, those terms you may have heard of. And so it's very common for us to have multiple specialists seeing one patient. And these are often for patients with sort of later stage heart disease, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, since you mentioned heart failure, and while we're on that topic, can you explain what that is? There's a difference between heart disease and heart failure then.
Right. So I'm glad you brought that up. And I think these terms really do throw out a lot of confusion for people.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for someone to say, oh, my mother died of a heart attack. And when you kind of sort of peel into the details of that, you find out it's a very different than what I would call a heart attack, for example. So heart failure, which is, again, this is my own personal lens, but it's a commonly recognized term that essentially means that there is an aberration of the pressure and fluid relationship with respect to the heart, okay? And that can happen for a lot of different reasons, okay? But the most common reasons are either heart artery blockages causing damage to the heart muscle and therefore causing it to weaken, and then that leads to the pressure and fluid to build up, or uncontrolled hypertension is also a very common cause. Those are probably the two most common causes that we see, but there's a lot of other things that we do look at in that realm. Yeah.
All right, so a heart attack, I would think of that as heart failure.
Yeah.
But...
And from an English dictionary standpoint, you wouldn't be wrong. Yeah. But from a medical, you were about to say what it's caused. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, no, I was just, it's different than heart failure. It's a result of heart failure, or what causes a heart attack, I guess.
So I think what most people mean when they say the word heart attack is what I would translate that to in a technical term would be an acute myocardial infarction. So myocardial is Latin for muscle of the heart, right? Infarction means part of that heart muscle dying, okay? And acute means it happens abruptly. And that is usually caused by a blockage in one of the arteries that supplies blood to the heart that suddenly closes off, okay? And that's, you know, a result of coronary artery disease and then the circumstance that may lead to a sudden acute closure, okay?
All right. Yeah. All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest is Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute cardiologist Dr. Jonathan McDonough. Today we are discussing heart disease and heart health. Please note we are live today and we do value your participation. So if you have a question about heart disease, heart health, please don't hesitate to give us a call. In Anchorage, our phone number is 907-550-8433. If you're listening outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. We will get your calls and emails on the air as they come in. Okay, so talked a little bit about heart failure, heart attack. I want to get back to heart attack at some point here, and talk about a little personal story that I had recently that you helped me navigate through. But can you talk about the different types of heart disease?
Sure. Yeah. So we touched on heart failure. And mm-hmm. I wanted to spend a little bit more on that. So
okay.
A big chunk of heart failure is what we call systolic heart failure. And that means primarily that we're talking of the four chambers of the heart. We're talking about the left ventricle, okay? The ventricles are the lower chambers of the heart. The right one pumps blood to the lungs. The left one pumps blood to the body.
Okay.
So the left one has a bigger job, in essence. It's got a big territory to pump to, and so it's bigger muscle. And weakening of that muscle can happen for a variety of reasons. But systolic heart failure is very common. And then if you add in people who have heart failure but with normal squeezing function, but a stiffness of the heart that causes an elevated pressure in the left ventricle, we call that diastolic heart failure. And that can happen for a variety of reasons too. If you add those two together, people with acute aberrations of heart failure, in other words, they become acutely worse over a period of days to weeks and end up in the hospital, is probably, I think, is still the number one cause of being hospitalized in this country, and at least based on sort of Medicare claims data. And so it's a big job trying to take care of, prevent, and treat people with heart failure symptoms. A large portion of those admissions to the hospital would likely be preventable with good care, okay? Or with access to care or showing up earlier. So that's something to keep in mind. The treatment of systolic heart failure has evolved incredibly over the past 30 years. I started medical school about 25 years ago. And at that time, any of the medicines that we give now would never have been given then. The first clinical trials of ACE inhibitors and beta blockers were done right around the time that I was in medical school. Those are two very commonly used types of medicines that haven't really changed much since then and have dramatically reduced the morbidity and mortality. So the chance that you're going to die or end up in the hospital from systolic heart failure has gone way down over the past, 25 to 30 years. And then when you factor in other treatments like newer medications that we have, special pacemakers to help the heart beat more efficiently, and in certain cases, special valve procedures or getting improved blood flow to the heart, this has been one of the greatest success stories of modern American medicine. Okay.
All right.
So heart failure is really important. The other sort of big categories of heart disease that, you know, so in my world, ischemic heart disease is incredibly important. So that's the buildup of plaque in the arteries that supply blood to the heart, right? And that's usually, in 99% of cases, due to a buildup of cholesterol, We call it atheroma or atherosclerosis, and then often that becomes calcified and can lead to blockages that cause people to have a lot of symptoms. And then if it causes an acute disturbance in blood flow, we talked about that before, people can get heart attacks.
Is that coronary artery disease?
That is coronary artery disease, yeah.
Another term. Right,
another term that people have heard. So coronary, the reason they're called coronaries, it's the same derivation of the word as corona or coronavirus, is because the arteries come out from the top of the heart and come down like a crown on top of the heart. And so that's how they got their name. And then rhythm disturbances of the heart, particularly atrial fibrillation, mm-hmm. is another huge area, right? And we can talk about that. But that causes a lot of issues for folks as we age. And for there's a wide range of how people present with AFib. And then what other? Hypertension. And then the last thing I would mention is valvular heart disease is also super common, especially from the aortic valve and to some extent the mitral valve.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to AFib because I want to touch on that. Yeah. But after, let's go ahead and we have a caller from Ketchikan calling in. Jim, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having this program.
Absolutely.
I had an incident there in the Anchorage Airport the other day, and I have bradycardia, so I ended up with a pacemaker in 2016. So yeah. I'm just curious, is there something now that a person with bradycardia has to be aware of for having an onset like I just recently did? Is there something we can be more proactive, be aware of these fainting issues so there's no more damage done?
That's a really good question. I'll try to answer as sort of generically as I can. It's going to be a little hard to get into your specific circumstance, but so bradycardic rhythm disorders, and I would, of course, defer to my electrophysiology colleagues to answer this question more precisely, but they're very common, and they become quite common as we age. And one, probably the most common reason is that the normal electrical conduction system of the heart in some folks basically just wears out due to a sclerosis process. And so it's very common in the very elderly to need a pacemaker, okay? There's not a lot that you can do to prevent that, to my knowledge. And there's not a lot that you can do to kind of head it off other than just be aware. You know, if you're somebody whose heart rate tends to run kind of low and it's getting lower, just being mindful of symptoms. And if you start to feel lightheaded, don't try to push through those, you know, maybe sit down, because people do sometimes faint, and we, you know, we call it syncope. And, you know, rarely that can be a life-threatening problem if you faint while you're driving or going down a long, steep staircase or something like that. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, Jim, thank you for the call. My dad has a pacemaker, too, and they're always, whenever he gets really tired or short of breath, I mean, they always call in and check. Right. The rhythms, I don't know. The technology is pretty amazing. They monitor it from Atlanta. Like, it's...
Yeah, the tech on pacemakers really has gone way up in ways that I don't even completely understand. But we're able to not just monitor the rhythm, but monitor the efficiency of the conduction with pacemakers and monitor... And some pacemakers will actually monitor your heart failure symptoms now because they are able to sense a change in impedance that might represent a change in the fluid status in the body. So it's pretty wild stuff. Yeah.
Science fiction.
Right. Yeah.
Body scan stuff. All right. We got some calls lining up. So we'll take one more before the break here. Looks like Frank in Willow. Go ahead. You're on line one.
Yeah, yes. About, I say, 10 or 15 years ago, I was diagnosed with a murmur. And every time I go see any kind of a doctor, they get wide open and they say, you have a heart murmur. And I don't know if it's getting worse. Should I get back to a heart doctor?
That's a great question. Excuse me for one sec. So the word murmur, I think generates a lot of confusion, okay? What that really means is that when a clinician puts a stethoscope on the chest, they can hear a whooshing sound that is a sound of blood being move through the heart in a somewhat turbulent manner. Okay. And so if the blood is flowing nice and smooth and laminarly through the heart, it will make less of a sound. Even you can even hear that in like in a child, you know, where the chest wall is thin enough, you can hear like just a normal flow murmur. But if you have, if your clinicians are getting wide-eyed looking at you, and especially as we get older, there are valvular heart problems that are good to diagnose before you get symptoms. So to me, that would be a sound reason to at least get an ultrasound of the heart or an echocardiogram, which is, you know, just that word just means Latin for ultrasound of the heart. And that's an incredibly powerful test and will tell you a lot of useful information. And it may be that whatever it is mild or moderate or doesn't need to be addressed right now, but knowing about it would be something to be good to be aware of. I'll just add to that. So I briefly mentioned valvular heart disease. It's one of my personal passions. I spend a lot of time dealing with folks with certain types of heart valve problems. And it is pretty common for us to be called to deal with it kind of late in the game. You know, like yeah. I get that a lot. And I would rather be there, you know, early in the game. So, I'm actually developing a grand rounds talk to give to a couple hospitals in different communities about this topic because it's an important one. And heart valve problems often go undiagnosed until it's almost too late or sometimes too late.
All right. Well, thank you, Frank, for the call. That's interesting. It sounds like you're talking about almost like preventative heart care. You don't wait until the wheels are wobbling before you take it to the mechanic.
It depends on the scenario, and sometimes it's okay to and appropriate to wait until symptoms develop.
Right.
But there are some things that are better to deal with earlier. So, yeah.
All right. Yeah. If you are just joining us, my guest is Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute cardiologist Dr. Jonathan McDonough. Today we are discussing heart disease and heart health. Please note we are live today, so we are taking phone calls and emails. If you have a question for Dr. McDonough or comment about today's topic, you can call us in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. You can reach us toll-free from anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I have a couple more phone calls. If you could hang on through the break here, we will get back to your calls. So, after a short break, we'll return for more of our conversation with Dr. Jonathan McDonough. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who are joining us late, my guest is Alaska Heart Institute cardiologist Dr. Jonathan McDonough. Today we are discussing heart disease and heart health. Please note, we are live and in studio today, so we're excited to be taking phone calls, and we got a bunch of them lining up. If you have a question or a comment, you can reach us in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Our toll-free number outside of Anchorage is 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, let's go ahead and I can't see the name because there's something over it, but there's a... Yes, Fred. Thank you to my producer. Fred, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. McDonough.
Good morning.
Are you familiar with Dr. Jeffrey Dixon and Dr. Ghost?
Yeah.
They're very good doctors. They're taking care of me at the Institute.
Wonderful.
And right now, my doctor is Dr. Jeffrey Dixon. And he's got me on a lot of pills. Yeah. I'm just wondering, do I need to take all those pills to keep me alive, or can I tone down on some of them?
That's a great question. I'm guessing that you take some pills for perhaps a weakened heart or blood pressure, And a lot of our folks also take pills for having been treated for a blocked artery. Is that kind of the camp that you're in?
I have congestive heart failure. Yeah. I guess it has to do with my muscle.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, kind of what I was talking about before. So I'm actually really glad that you called and asked this question because it is a lot of pills. And I don't like taking pills either. You know, nobody likes to take pills. And so it's a very reasonable question. Do you really need all these? And what I will tell you is that the rationale for it is pretty darn sound, okay? When people have done clinical trials to look at what helps people with systolic heart failure, what has been done over the years is essentially a layering of medications on top of each other. So, you know, the first one was an ACE inhibitor and then beta blockers, and then a medicine called spironolactone, which you may be on. And then about 10 years ago, a medicine called Entresto kind of replaced the ACE inhibitor. And each one of those clinical trials showed not only a reduction in symptoms of heart failure, but a reduction in the chance of dying from heart failure. And the impacts are pretty darn meaningful. If you look at the Entresto clinical trial, which was done over a period of, I have to go back and pull it up, but let's say it was about 3 years. And at the end of that 3-year period, if you didn't take the Entresto, maybe there was a 20% chance of being dead. And if you took it, maybe it was down to 12%. So it was roughly in that range of impact. Don't quote me on those numbers, please, because I always have to pull up the study
right,
to actually look at it. But it was a very highly impactful trial. And so, and then even more recently, we're putting patients with heart failure on a type of medicine called an SGLT2 inhibitor, which was originally developed to treat diabetes, but it turns out also these medicines appear to pretty dramatically improve the chance of being hospitalized or dying with systolic heart failure, and that's where you may be on a medicine called Jardiance. Now, one of the things that always kind of gets me personally is that up until about 10 years ago, all the medicines that I prescribed were essentially available generically. They'd all been around for a long time, were kind of tried and true medicines and inexpensive. And now we've got two classes of medicines, primarily the Entresto and the SGLT2 inhibitors, that are still under patent and more pricey. So that bothers me because it does, you know, raise the cost of care. However, I will say that the impacts are quite meaningful. And so, it's always a struggle, I think, to help people feel good about taking a lot of pills. And I totally get that. But if Dr. Dixon prescribed him, and I know Dr. Dixon very well personally, he's a very thoughtful guy. I suspect that you probably should stay on those. Yeah.
Thank you, Fred, for that call. I think that's
last week, and they took the EKG. I thought it was a long process.
Uh-huh.
Like a staff shot, and I'm doing fine. So, you know, you guys do great work over there at the Institute. I highly praise all you doctors for all the schooling and expertise that you have. And I just want to say thank you to you and the Institute.
Oh, yeah. It's a privilege to be able to do the work we do. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Fred, for the call. Yeah. And I think one of the things to think about is if you're on a lot of meds is to maybe – make sure you go over it with your doctor, right?
Every
so often, say, hey,
yeah,
I'm on all these, especially if there's multiple doctors
correct
prescribing things. But if it's one doctor and you go through it, he can generally tell you, you're taking this for this reason and this for that reason.
Yeah, and keeping, if you have several doctors with lots of different people prescribing, you know, bringing the medicines with you or making sure that your list is 100% accurate when you see a doctor is extremely helpful, because It's a problem when somebody comes in and says, I don't really know what I'm taking, because it's really hard to know where to go from there sometimes.
Yeah, because how do you give somebody another medication when you don't know how it's going to interact with certain meds? Because those can be tricky once you get a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to keep going with phone calls. David in Anchorage, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I was, thank you for taking my call. I was interested in the status of the technologies that are being used to like grow hearts, and also the use of CRISPR in heart disease.
Yeah, those are good questions, neither of which I am a real expert in. The CRISPR one, we're starting to get close to. So gene therapy, so the first drug that we are sort of commonly available for at like people with sort of common problems is inclisiran, which is a short, it's a small inhibiting RNA molecule that basically dramatically reduces cholesterol production in the liver. There's somebody else out there who would slaughter me for the way I said that. But in that, so I believe that that was developed somewhat through the use of those types of technologies. It's not gene editing like CRISPR is, but it's kind of in that zone. There is I know of some basic science that has looked at CRISPR derived gene editing to treat familial hyperlipidemia. So these are folks who are born with very high cholesterols and have very high incidences of heart disease. And I think there's hope on the horizon there for like a durable lifetime preventive treatment there. So, and then I'm sure we'll see other things there. In terms of growing like new hearts or new heart tissue from stem cells, there's people doing that work, and it's years off in my understanding from being applicable to humans.
If you could grow your own heart, that would be like from your own tissue. That would be pretty.
That would be cool.
That'd be crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Let's just keep. Thank you, David, for that. That was an interesting question on the future of heart medicine. Let's go to line two. Frank has been holding for quite some time. Thank you for your patience, Frank. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was diagnosed with AFib a couple years ago and basically brought back from the dead by Alaska Heart Institute. And now got a pacemaker, which I really love. But I'd like to hear the doctor describe the importance of sleep and the role of sleep apnea in AFib. And I'll take it off the air.
That's a great question. Sleep is so important for so many things. So
That is a great question. And I mean, your question kind of answers itself. I think we all believe that quality sleep is very important for your health in general. Certainly for your nervous system health, and probably also your heart rhythm health. When you start delving into the research in this, because it's not, you know, this is sort of associative research, right? It's observational. It becomes a little bit messy. But that said, sleep apnea is clearly a trigger for heart rhythm disorders and also hypertension, okay? So bad sleep apnea, constantly waking up, having your blood oxygen levels go low, leads to high levels of circulating, norepinephrine and epinephrine at night. And that, by the theories, makes your blood pressure go up, makes the strain on your heart go up, causes rhythm disturbances. And so we're pretty aggressive at Alaska Heart in terms of if you have AFib and have any symptoms to suggest sleep apnea, you should probably get that checked out. You know, sleep apnea is a tough disease for some people. For some people, treating it with CPAP masks works great and people feel a lot better. And other people do have difficulty tolerating that. So, but it's worth kind of just putting the elbow grease in to figure it out and see if you can improve on it. There's other things that disturb sleep too, right? So mainly life, right? So, you know, staying up too late with screens is bad for your sleep. Alcohol is terrible for your sleep, especially as you get older. So, you know, not drinking too much alcohol, especially not drinking any within a few hours, like I think at least 2 hours of bedtime will improve your sleep quality. And that will probably also reduce your chance of AFib. Alcohol itself is also a trigger for heart rhythm disturbances, right? So especially atrial fibrillation. So if you want to try to prevent AFib, sleep well, keep your blood pressure controlled, don't drink alcohol, at least not too much.
All right, let's go to line seven. Got a question from Dr. Sprott. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on line one.
Yes, this is James Sprott. I'm a retired hematologist who lived in Anchorage for many years since the mid-70s.
Wonderful.
And always I've been taught my whole life that saturated fat is bad for you. And I've read a few things recently by some people who are, sound like they have done their research, bringing into mark question the early epidemiological studies and how that's pushed as the only answer to coronary artery disease. And I don't know what to make of it. It's completely different than everything I've always read in the past. I'd like your thoughts on the role of saturated fat in heart disease.
That's a great question, Dr. Sprott, because it's confusing to me too. You're absolutely right that the association between high saturated fat intake and high LDL cholesterol is kind of old and perhaps somewhat messy research. I'm not an endocrinologist or a metabolic expert at all. Okay, what seems to be consistent from an outcome standpoint is that polyunsaturated fats are probably healthier than saturated fats, right? So that's been borne out in a few clinical trials and also observational data of people who eat a lot of fish, right? So if you're betting in Vegas, I'd bet on the polyunsaturated fats as healthier. Does that mean that for everybody, butter is a bad thing? Well, it might be that genetically some people's cholesterol goes up with butter and other people's doesn't. So I think it's a mixed answer, but I'm glad you asked it. I'll probably do some more reading after the show on this because every year or so I get sort of curious about the same question and start to try to delve into it and end up in the same sort of, I'm not sure, place. But I do think that there is fairly strong associative science between saturated fats and cholesterol, for some people at least, and that polyunsaturated fats are healthier. So if I'm telling patients what to eat, I tend to say hit the fish and vegetables, nuts, legumes, I'm not saying never on beef, but probably less. Right.
All right. That's a great question. I know the information seems to change here and there. Margarine was the big craze and artificial sweeteners. Now they're out. It shifts. And, a lot of it is lifestyle, too. My grandparents ate incredible amounts of bacon and saturated fat and lard and worked on a farm their whole lives and lived into their 90s with relatively healthy hearts. So, and I guess you're looking at different populations of people who eat certain diets, and that's where a lot of that sort of data comes from, I imagine. But thank you, Dr. Sprott, for the call. All right, we got one more call I want to get to. John on line four, go ahead. You're on line one.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. Hey, I got friends that have had stents put in, and it seems like they find out that they need them by serendipity. And my other question is, does psoriasis affect your heart? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, John.
I'll touch on the psoriasis for a second. I'm not aware of any direct link between psoriasis and heart disease other than some people with psoriasis get a pretty bad inflammatory arthritis. And maybe in a general sense that inflammation could affect heart disease, but that's about as much as I would know about that. Okay. As far as needing stents, so stents, and I would put in the category of what we call revascularization, so improving blood flow to the heart.
Yeah, what is a stent?
Yeah, and so the two methods of revascularization would either be a bypass surgery, like an open heart surgery to reroute using the patient's own blood vessels, either a vein or an artery from the inside of the chest wall, to reroute it to the heart to go around a blockage, or an endovascular approach, meaning going inside the artery with tubes and wires. That's what I do. in deploying a stent often. And a stent is essentially a wire mesh tube. Some people describe it kind of like one of those Japanese finger trap kind of things.
Yeah.
Modern stents are made out of very thin wire mesh that's measured in micrometers, okay, and have medication on the outside, actually similar to some types of chemotherapy to reduce the amount of inflammation and cell proliferation that can occur after a stent goes in order to prevent the stent from re-narrowing, okay? And stents are implanted by threading them over a special wire that's threaded down a blocked artery. And the wire kind of acts like a train track, if you will, and allows us to deliver one of these stents that's compressed and into a thin little tiny tube almost. And then it's on top of a special balloon. The balloon is inflated and used to kind of mash the stent up against the wall of the artery. Huh. And it stays there forever. Reasons to put stents in, you know, not every blocked artery needs a stent. Not every blocked artery causes a problem. If a big artery to your heart is suddenly occluded, or, you know, and this also applies to the brain or to other parts of your body, if it's suddenly occluded, that causes a heart attack, or if it's the brain, it's a stroke. That is a very important reason to put a stent in, okay? Because that can be relieved in minutes with that. And, you know, that's to me is amazing how somebody will come to the ER seemingly in a lot of distress and, you know, looks like they're about to die from a heart attack, and then 15 minutes later, everything's fine. Other reasons to put a stent in, some people develop narrowings in the arteries that happen more slowly over time, so they don't present with acute heart attacks, but people do have symptoms of exertional limitations. So when they walk upstairs or try to do stuff, they get chest pressure or feel winded or feel out of gas. They can't get their motor going. And in some circumstances, stents or heart surgery might be helpful there to improve those symptoms. You know, if somebody is truly asymptomatic, has no symptoms at all, there are rare circumstances where a stent might be a good idea, but they may not need a stent at all. They may just need medicines to prevent the problem from getting worse.
All right, so a result of something happening.
Something happening or some symptom we're trying to treat. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John, for the question. If you're just tuning in today, my guest is Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute cardiologist Dr. Jonathan McDonough. We are discussing heart disease and heart health. Please note we are live today. We will be able to take maybe a couple more phone calls. We cleared the board there, so that was good. If you have a question for Dr. McDonough or comment about today's topic, you can call us in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. If you're listening outside of Anchorage, you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. I have some emails here that I'll read, but we'll do that after a short break. We will come back with more of our conversation with Dr. Jonathan McDonough. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in late, my guest is Dr. Jonathan McDonough, who is a cardiologist at the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. Today, we are discussing heart disease and heart health. Our Anchorage phone number is 907-550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, phone calls are rolling in again, but I do want to get to a couple of emails, and I haven't really had a chance to ask my questions, but fortunately a lot of these are, and this is one of them. Hypertension, the writer says, great show today. What blood pressure is considered hypertension, and does hypertension cause heart disease? I mean, I had a round here recently where my blood pressure was up 160s over 120s. I called you. You called me meds, and they went down. I don't like to take meds like everybody else who calls, and I was pretty proud of being 57 and no meds, and you told me it wasn't very smart to keep, I think that was, you want to do something about that. So the role of hypertension, high blood pressure, what is it, and what does it do to the heart?
Yeah, super important question. So, you know, 60 years ago or so, we, as a society, thought that blood pressure going up with age was sort of a normal thing and didn't treat it. And then, you know, you guys, people may be familiar with the anecdote of Franklin Roosevelt, who died of his, you know, cerebral artery essentially exploding from that, you know. And so in the past, you know, basically since 1950, there's been a ton of research that has looked into treating hypertension. Hypertension is something that happens to many of us, if not most of us, as we age. So as we get older, our blood pressure goes up a little bit, okay? It's also caused by genetics, okay? It's made worse by things like sleep apnea, obesity, alcohol, okay? Too much salt, not enough exercise. So you can treat some of your hypertension by correcting those things, but some people can't, okay? Hypertension, so the two things I would say is we kind of suck in this country at really getting people on the program with it. There's a lot of under-treated or not treated hypertension out there. And it's the number one risk factor for heart disease and stroke.
That's the big one, huh?
Yeah. And so it's bigger than cholesterol. It's, I guess, not as big as age because you can't do anything about age.
Right.
Smoking is also a very powerful risk factor. So I kind of wasn't counting smoking because y'all know you shouldn't smoke. And
cigarettes are bad.
Yeah, cigarettes are bad. But a huge chunk of preventable heart disease in this country is attributed to undertreated hypertension. And so, yeah, you should know your blood pressure. What's normal blood pressure? Most recent guidelines, so a resting blood pressure greater than 130 is mild hypertension, you know. And probably we should be treating into the 120s for the systolic number, the top number.
Okay? Right.
And yeah, that's kind of the story there. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Blood pressure. So I know hypertensive crisis is anything over 180, right? Like,
yeah, there's different, you know, numbers there. So you can have a blood pressure of 180 but not have any symptoms, okay? Right. And that's not an emergency. You don't need to go to the ER for that. You just need to deal with it, okay? We're treating hypertension for the long-term risk reduction. There are rare symptoms or syndromes of people with severely elevated blood pressure acutely who become ill enough that they have to go to the ER because they have a bad headache, which, you know, might in theory be heralding a sign of like a cerebral artery rupture, or have bad chest pain, or an acute aortic syndrome, which is a whole nother category we probably don't have time to get into. But most people, blood pressure is rarely an emergency, but it's still very important to treat.
Yeah. All right, we have a lot of calls lined right back up again. Yeah. Let's go ahead and go to line six. We'll take David in Juneau. You have a question about cardiac medicine.
Yes, I was wondering if you could talk about statins and any of the side effects you would have with statins or Lipitor.
Great question. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because I've been trying to edge my way in here to talk about cholesterol. So, in terms of like material on the internet about a drug class, there's statins, you know, they win the game, okay? There's more opinions about statins than just about anything in terms of medical care. A couple things about cholesterol. High LDL cholesterol isn't the only cause or the only thing that you need to get heart disease or atherosclerotic heart disease, I should say, blockages in the arteries. But it's essentially a necessary component. And so a lot of us feel that if we were more aggressive with treating cholesterol with both diet and potentially medications for the right people and blood pressure, you know, my life might be a lot easier.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't get to do all the fun heart attack stopping procedures in the middle of the night if we were better about all that stuff, you know. I'm kind of quotes around fun. I'm just...
I got you.
Yeah. Statins were discovered, or the first, actually, the first statins came around about 30 years ago. And sometimes people do get side effects. So Lipitor is a very good medicine. It's been well studied. There are many clinical trials showing that it absolutely reduces the rate of heart attack and stroke, especially in people who are at higher risk. Some people get muscle aches on statins. There is debate about how much of this is attributable to a statin or just the fact that some people get muscle aches, okay? There's a smaller study using placebo that showed that there wasn't a huge difference between the placebo and the statins, but I think it is a real thing. Some people will say, my muscles get really sore. And then you may have to back off on the dose, try alternative agents, which thankfully we now have alternatives. The reason we use statins first before those alternatives is, again, they have the most robust collection of evidence that support their use in terms of reducing the bad outcome that we want to use. The other things we can use are things like ezetimibe, which helps reduce the reabsorption of cholesterol in the small bowel, PCSK9 inhibitors, which work in the liver to stop the transfer of cholesterol from one spot to another, and so on.
All right. Yeah. Cholesterol. Yeah. So there's another question up here on the board about sugar and cholesterol relationship.
Yeah.
From I guess we can go ahead and take that phone call on line one. Carla, you're on line one. You have a question about sugar and cholesterol?
I do. I've heard rumblings about it's not the fat or the cholesterol per se, but it's the sugar in combination with those. Is there any correlation between sugar and cholesterol and perhaps types of cholesterol that would form a problem?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of what I'm looking at. So, yeah.
Yeah, really good question. Yeah. So I guess the way I think about it is that type 2 diabetes is a scourge, right? It afflicts a lot of folks, and it's primarily a problem of metabolism. So an often sort of muscle metabolism, which is our biggest metabolic engine in the body. And when you have insulin resistance, which starts well before you have type 2 diabetes, that means that your insulin levels are high relative to the amount of sugar you're either ingesting or what is in your bloodstream. If you eat more carbohydrate and produce even more insulin itself causes inflammation and is a growth factor for the development of atherosclerosis. So probably you're right that you need a kind of a combination of insulin resistance and cholesterol to really create atherosclerosis, or at least a lot of people have that. Not everybody has that. And so if you can decrease the amount of sugar and decrease your insulin resistance by both exercise and diet, that may be quite beneficial in terms of preventing atherosclerosis.
All right, I got time for one more quick one on line eight. You have a question, Bill, about arrhythmia?
Oh, yeah, I heard Dr. Sprott's voice, and he treated me in 2003, and he listened to my heart for a long time. He said, you got arrhythmia, but I don't think he'd send you in. But I'll probably come in and see you. You sound great, Prentice. Another thing is I got LPHD, and I basically stopped getting my Reed Sternberg cells, popcorn-looking cells, when I stopped eating canola oil. I'm going to take the rest off there. Great, great show. Thank you.
I didn't quite catch it. So,
not sure what the question was, but...
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm running out of time here. I only got a couple minutes left. I'm sorry, Bill, we didn't quite get your question. But I do have one email in here. Long COVID, does that impact the heart? Have you worked much with long COVID or how that impacts the heart?
We've definitely seen folks who've had COVID who then develop symptoms that may be related and affect the cardiovascular system. It's a it's a little frustrating area in terms of knowing what's causing what, right?
Right.
But autonomic symptoms after COVID seem to be a real thing. And I wish there was better science around that, to be frank. I've had a number of patients who struggled with, you know, who were basically healthy and fit before COVID and then struggled with symptoms of dysautonomia, so their heart rate's going way out of control or feeling really dizzy with physical activity. I really can't say more than that. I would just be a sort of all conjecture. We basically try to help those patients as best we can with medicines, tincture of thyme, in some rare circumstances, perhaps other things, but yeah.
All right. One more question I have is coronary artery disease. We only got like a minute left, but the plaque buildup, how do they tell, how can they tell inside if your arteries are blocked, if you have a lot of blockage?
Yeah. The most important thing there is symptoms and prevention.
Okay.
So you may have plaque in your arteries, but if your blood pressure is controlled, your cholesterol is controlled, and you're not having any symptoms, then maybe defining that or knowing that is less important, okay? Symptoms drive treatment of coronary heart disease. So exertional chest pain, exertional shortness of breath, sudden chest pain, those are reasons to really seek it out.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jonathan McDonough from the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. I appreciate you being here today.
That's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we generate a lot of interest, so maybe we'll have to do that again. My thanks also to Line One producer Madeline Rose and for my engineer Chris Hyde. For all of us at Line One, we appreciate you taking the time to listen today. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.